Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel for an exclusive conversation, the annual Back to School on the Markets conversation with Jeffrey Gundlach, the Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer, and founder of DoubleLine Capital. Today's special conversation will cover a wide range of timely macro and market topics, among them U.S. trade policy, monetary policy, and positioning guidance across asset classes, including, of course, fixed income. Now, before we move into our conversation today, some quick background here on Jeffrey Gundlach. Jeffrey is recognized as an expert in bonds and other debt-related investments. In 2011, he appeared on the cover of Barron's as the new bond king. In 2012, Bloomberg Markets magazine named him as one of the 50 most influential. In 2013, Jeffrey was named Money Manager of the Year by Institutional Investor. In 2015, Bloomberg Markets magazine again named Jeffrey as one of the 50 most influential. Jeffrey is a graduate of Dartmouth College, summa cum laude, with degrees in mathematics and philosophy. So with that, Jeffrey, as always, it is great to have you back here on UBS On Air for this annual conversation. Thank you for joining our listeners, our clients, and very much looking forward to hearing your insights today.
All right. Thanks for having me, Dan. It's kind of turns to a tradition.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeffrey. We always look forward to this, and I know there is much going on in the markets at the moment. Maybe to begin, it would be very helpful if we hear an overview from you, Jeffrey, in terms of how you're assessing the current macroeconomic environment, spanning trade policy to monetary policy, coming off of the recent Fed meeting, how you're viewing fixed income markets, and what this all means for your overall positioning at the moment.
Well, it's definitely been a moving target since we had the tariff tantrum back in late March, early April. Things sort of calmed down, but, you know, we have some pretty big tariffs going on with India and China. And I expect that there's going to be more volatility around trade policy. The real question, I know this is the question that Jay Powell discussed at the Fed meeting recently. The real question is, what's going to be the inflationary impact on tariffs once they really start rolling through? I think it's been a little bit longer lead time on tariffs showing up in price data, but we've been operating under the kind of, you know, it's kind of a finger in the air thing because the policy keeps changing, but we think that the tariffs will probably lead to difficulty for the Federal Reserve to make progress towards what they state is their goal of 2% year-over-year inflation. You know, I think our inflation model, when we try to factor in tariffs, it kind of comes out that it might add about a half of 1% to the CPI on the headline number. And the CPI, as Jay Powell pointed out, is already rising, and most inflation measures have stopped falling. You know, Dan, it's interesting. It's almost hard to believe, but if you look at the inflation back 5 years ago, we had, you know, the COVID lockdown and all that stimulus, and the Fed didn't start raising interest rates until March of 2022. And at that time, the CPI had risen to above 7%, which is kind of shocking that we would have a 0 to 25 basis point Fed funds rate with the inflation rate having gone from around 2% to over 7. And you can remember that we talked about, or Jay Powell and the Fed people talked about inflation being transitory. And that became sort of a big egg on the face problem because the inflation rate went all the way up to 9.1% and stayed there. And we still haven't seen anything really that close. We got ish close to 2% on the CPI, but then it started rising again. So the thing that I'd like to follow is what the two-year Treasury is doing relative to the Fed funds rate. And I talk about this a lot, and a lot of people push back on me for this, but I don't understand why they do, because the data is remarkably clear that the Federal Reserve follows the two-year Treasury yield. Back when they started raising interest rates, in 2022, you know, the 2-year treasury yield had gone up before they started hiking, gone up to about 200 basis points, and it was going straight vertical. And in more recent times, the past 2 years, the 2-year treasury yield has been below the Fed's funds rate for every single monthly reading, going back to late 2022. So one of the reasons I think that the Fed called it a recalibration on cutting rates or an insurance policy is that the 2-year treasury had gotten to a pretty big spread below the Fed funds rate, and they need to get closer to it. So right now, the 2-year treasury is about 68 basis points or so below the Fed funds rate, which I think is one of the reasons why the Fed is likely to cut interest rates further. It's interesting, we got a pretty strong GDP report today at 3.8% real for the most recent quarter. And it's interesting that the market doesn't like it. The stock market's down for the third day in a row, which hasn't happened in a while, and interest rates are up. It's kind of like, it's interesting that it feels like good news is sort of bad news because the markets have been really relying on easier monetary policy and hoping for, you know, sequential rate cuts. And at times, the market's been looking for something like 5 cuts over the course of the next year. We got 1 cut. But Fed policy is now very much uncertain, I would say. If you look at what came out of the SEP at the most recent Fed meeting, you've got one Fed governor wants to hike rates coming up, and a bunch of them want them unchanged, and then about 9 of them want them cut about 50 basis points. And then you've got this new curveball that's entered this picture, which is, I don't know if the name is Myron or Miron. I've heard pronounced both ways in almost equal quantities. But he's looking for 5 rate cuts, which is pretty much in line, I'm sure, with what the administration in the White House wants. And the big question coming up for all of this is, what is going to be the effect of the tariffs? Will we get the inflation rate up in not in the 2s anymore, but in the 3s? That's what our work is suggesting. And what's going to happen when Jay Powell gets replaced? Because his replacement is probably going to have to go through, the president will interview candidates. And I really think, to put it very simplistically, I think the question that's going to be asked in the job interview is, are you going to set rates where I, Donald Trump, want them? And if that's the case, we could be looking at a pretty significant change in the real interest rate of the Fed funds rate, from now a positive real interest rate to one that would be negative, which of course would be an inflationary policy. So we have a lot of change coming in the next, call it 7 months or so, with the impacts of the tariffs still not being fully felt. I do notice that we got a lot of commentary in the media, appropriately, that the CEO of Walmart expected significant price increases to start with the back to school. Now, that's partly in the numbers. One would think that the inflation numbers for August would have a piece of that, but it'll be interesting to see what the path is. And so the markets are pretty much on edge. What we've seen, though, are some really longer-term, very strong indicators of weakening economy. And I think the Fed realizes that, and they're clearly with their easing, they are now choosing to try to get the employment market healthier, because it's been revised down by 1.7 million jobs in the past couple of months. And Jay Powell appropriately, I'm glad he said this because it shows that he's on the case, he said, you know, that we used to get 100,000 to 150,000 jobs at the establishment survey the first Friday of every month. And now it's downshifting to something that he said was maybe 0 to 50, which is a pretty low number. And so that's motivating the Fed to do things. But when we started 2025, Jay Powell had his very best press conference of his Fed chairmanship back in January, because things were going his way. He talked about how policy was in a really good place. They have kind of a balance with their dual mandate of, you know, trying to get to 2% inflation while maintaining full employment. But with every passing meeting, these two different mandates have become in greater and greater tension. And now I think everybody is talking about the tension between the inflation rate, which is rising, and which is unwanted, and the employment rate, which is rising, which is unwanted. So we really have a lot of Fed cuts that are built into market pricing. And when we get good news like today, and late last week, there was some pretty decent economic news as well, one has to wonder what's going to happen with the inflation rate. So we've been negative on long-term bonds, the Treasury bonds, for now about 2 years. We're not negative on Treasuries broadly, but we think that these inflationary policies and this interest expense and this budget deficit, which for fiscal 2024, which is just about over, it's running at about 7.1% of GDP, which is higher than last year, which was higher than the year before that, which was higher than the year before that. So with all of, the economic recovery from where we were back when we had to do all that stimulus, it's amazing that when you look at the coupon treasuries, not the T-bills, but the coupon treasuries, the issuance is the same as it was at the maximum peak of the stimulus back in 2021, 2022. And so we really have a very substantial interest expense problem. I've been talking about this now for quite a few quarters, but we were running an interest expense on the budget of $300 billion per year, and now it's at $1.4 trillion, and the budget deficit continues to add bonds, and interest rates are somewhat well-behaved, but we have a lot of bonds that are coming due that have low coupons on them that have to be replaced with new bonds that are now, in the 4% zone. So I'm worried that you're not going to get a reaction that you usually get from long-term treasuries, and it's already panning out that way. The Fed started easing over a year ago, and the long-term treasury bond is up in yield and down in price by about 8 or 9% in total return. So not like what used to be, that when the Fed started easing, you had the curve steepen, but you had long rates fall, just not as much as short rates. This time, the 30-year Treasury bond yield has been going up, and it's not just the United States. This is happening in the UK, it's happening in Japan, it's happening in Germany, where long-term bond yields have gone up pretty sharply, even though we've seen easing policies, at least in the United States. So when I'm looking at the economy, there's the three things that have caught my attention. I'm not looking at the wiggles and jiggles stuff. I'm looking at data sets that have had very strong histories of not giving false signals, not giving many signals at all, but pretty much accurately predicting the increase in the unemployment rate. So for example, the 2s-10s yield curve, just the spread of the yield between the 2-year and the 10-year, it is highly correlated to the U3 unemployment rate. And once you go inverted for 2s-10s and then you start steepening, which is exactly what's been happening now for over a year, you start to see every time an increase in the U3 unemployment rate. That has happened this time as well, but it's not accelerating to the upside yet anyway. Yet the spread has really increased, and that has been a very good indicator for a recession. Another one is the U3 unemployment rate versus its 3-year moving average. When the U3 unemployment rate crosses above its 3-year moving average, that has been exactly coincident with the front edge of the last 4 recessions. And so that has happened. It's above its three-year moving average. And so we're on watch for rising, rising unemployment and perhaps some weakness in the economy, which hasn't shown up yet, at least not in the most recent data with a 3.8 real GDP. And then the U.S. yield curve steepening before the recession, the 2s-10s yield curve versus its 12-month moving average is a fantastic indicator of economic coming weakness, particularly when the 12-month moving average of the 2s-10s spread goes above zero. When the 12-month moving average de-inverts, that has been extremely strong indicator of the front edge of recessions going all the way back to 1980. So these are things that we're watching closely. We're not negative on 5-year Treasury bonds, 10-year Treasury bonds, a little bit not as positive. When it comes to like 3-year Treasury bonds, 5-year Treasury bonds, we're fine with those, and they've done very well. But one of the consequences of the policies that have been in place, one has to admit, has been a very strong rally in risk assets. Obviously, the stock market in the U.S. is having a good year, but stock markets away from the U.S. are doing even better, which is something that we talked about a year ago and that I reiterated in my Just Markets webcast in early January. I recommended investors might have 40 or 50% of their assets in stocks, but I went so far as to say I think all of the stocks should be non-U.S. stocks, because my forecast for a lower dollar, which has certainly come to pass, will lead to currency translations that are very favorable for U.S. dollar-based investors. And so while the S&P's done well, some of the European markets with currency translation, some of the Asian markets are up in the 20s, where, you know, the S&P's doing well, up double digits, but you've got about another extra 10% from the currency translation. And I actually, more recently, say maybe 3 months ago, we introduced to some of our riskier bond portfolios, where the risk appetite is higher, local currency emerging market bonds for the first time in forever, it seems like, because now emerging market currencies are also appreciating, not all of them, but as a basket, versus the U.S. dollar. And I think this is going to continue. I think that that we have an environment which is highly unusual. This is one of these periods, I've talked about this really for the past 3-4 years, that experience in markets, if you have 45 years experience that I nearly have, one thing that can be bad is if you've only experienced a nonstop secular trend, you might think that that is always in place. And what I'm saying by that is falling interest rates. Interest rates are not falling anymore secularly, at least not at the long end, and they're certainly well off their lows at the short end. So maybe when you have rising interest rates instead of falling interest rates, things will act differently. And I think that's sort of showing up in some of these markets. You know, we have outperformance of these currency translations, and the best performing bonds are emerging markets anyway, for U.S. investors. But if you have them in local currency, it's even better. I would have about 20% of my bond allocation, which I would say should probably be about, 35% of a portfolio. I might have a quarter of that, or at least 20% in local currency emerging market bonds, because you have higher yields, you have better economic, but you have better budget fundamentals where you don't have as high of a debt to GDP. The U.S. is 50% higher in debt to GDP than a basket of emerging markets. So it's higher yielded, and I think you make money on the currency translation. Another thing that's interesting that has been very different from the past is back during the tariff tantrum, back in April, May, there was a correction in the stock market. And going back to about 2000, the corrections in the stock market have been associated with a rising dollar. So it would be a flight to quality. When stock markets go down, the dollar acts as a safe haven. But that didn't happen earlier this year. As the stock market went into a correction for the first time in well over a decade, you've seen there have been 13 corrections going back over the time period that I'm referencing, and this is the first time that the dollar went down. For every time, the 12 before this one earlier this year, the dollar went up on average by about 8 or 9%. This time it went down by 8 or 9%. So I think that you're not going to see long-term treasuries act as a safe haven against economic risk or a risk-off environment unless, and this is a huge caveat that cannot be discounted, unless the government comes in and does yield curve control. Because if yields go up too much, I think there's been a lot of conversation fairly out in the open from the Treasury Secretary of sort of changing the way that the debt is managed by having fewer long-term bonds and more short-term bonds. But what's really amazing about that is we're already there. The issuance of Treasuries is 84% 1 year and in. in the Treasury bond market. 84% of it has a maturity of less than 1 year. And when you look at the maturities that are issued 20 years and longer, it's only 1.75% of the Treasuries. So in spite of the fact that there aren't many long bonds as a share of all the Treasuries outstanding, the yields are going up. So we've seen yield curve control in the United States in the aftermath of World War II. The inflation rate was going up, but they didn't allow long rates to go up, or short rates for that matter. And so they were running a negative interest rate. And I'm afraid that that might happen again, until such time as the Treasury might manipulate the yield by buying the Treasuries, just buying back the long-term Treasury bonds, in which case you would have a very sharp rally. So, Dan, my positioning has been underweight and even in some portfolios short the 30-year Treasury bond, owning instead the duration using threes to fives. But I think, you know, you might have to be on guard for after, if there's upward interest rate pressure, which is abated for now. But if it reemerges, I think you might see some intervention, and you might have to think carefully about reintroducing long-term Treasury bonds, but we're not at that position yet. So with the stock market doing well pretty much globally, it's not surprising that spreads on risk products, non-Treasury products in the fixed income market, are very, very low by historical standards. I think that that's not likely to change quickly unless we go into a significant risk-off environment, kind of definitionally. But we have been upgrading portfolios systematically for the past couple of years in a very gradualistic, monotonic basis, really reducing triple C's in funds that are leveraged, like our closed-end funds, reducing leverage to the lowest levels that we've ever had since the history of double lined 16 years ago. And so we want to have buying power. We want to have buying power to reintroduce these assets when they're more attractive versus Treasuries. So we're in a fairly low-risk position in most of our funds, and we have been pretty much exiting triple C securities and avoiding, say, double B CLOs, things like that, because the reward that you're getting is very, very low. And we've been rotating away from floating rate securities now for a while now, for about a year and a half, because we anticipated the Fed was going to need to start cutting interest rates because they were so out of sync with the pricing in the bond market. They're more in sync now. But just looking at that SEP, the dot plot, I've never seen in my career, of course, they didn't do the dot plot when I started in this business, but I've never seen so much disagreement as we had in the meeting here in September. So with that, Dan, that's my overview. I'm happy to answer some other questions you have.
Appreciate that, Jeffrey. Very comprehensive from a positioning standpoint. Currently, our chief investment office with the fixed income allocation has in favor MBS as well as IG corporates. Any views on those subsectors?
I think IG corporates offer very little incremental yield, but they're not very risky. So you're getting, they're in the 70s on the spread now, which is about as tight as it ever gets. But the quality of the loan management, the borrowing management by the CFOs has been really good. I mean, they handled it much better than the Treasury Department did. When rates were low, down at zero, even though inflation was rising, rising to up towards 9%, they were taking advantage of low rates and tight spreads and pushing out maturities. So we own investment-grade bonds. We don't think you're going to do great in them because it's very unlikely you're going to have a price gain. Mortgage-backed securities were very attractive about 4 months ago, and we were adding to that. And we still like mortgage-backed securities, even though the spreads have come in about 30-35 basis points from where they were 4 months ago. One of the reasons we like mortgage-backed securities is we think that if there's going to be government intervention, it's quite possible that intervention is out there to help one of the worst things in our economy, which is housing affordability. Housing affordability is worse now than it was prior to the global financial crisis because home prices are up a lot and mortgage rates are up. And so it's a fascinating study that's done, I think, by the Atlanta Fed, where they take the housing cost. So if you, assuming you have to get a mortgage and you pay the current interest rate and you have to pay insurance and maybe PMI, they take all the costs of, you know, of owning a home through a mortgage, and then they take the mortgage amount that's needed, assuming like an 80 LTV, and then they say what's the interest rate, and they compare it to median household income. And right now, the housing cost as a percentage of the median household income, this is nationwide, is 48%, which is the highest since this began. And just 3 years ago, it was down at about 28%. So it's gone from 28% of household income to 48% nationwide. And if you go to some of the metropolitan areas, like the one that I'm in right now, in the Los Angeles metro area, which includes Los Angeles, Long Beach, and Anaheim, amazingly, the median household income is the housing cost is 90% of median household income. And that median household income is pre-tax. So after tax, it's well over 100% of mean household income. So everybody is aware that there's a massive housing affordability problem. One way to get at that would be to engineer mortgage rates lower, perhaps by a quantitative easing program. I know they're doing the opposite right now in a minimal way, but I think that it's quite possible that mortgage rates are engineered lower with the help of the Treasury Department. And we'll see if that happens. If it does, mortgage spreads could come in substantially further. They could come into maybe below 100 basis points, maybe down to 80, more like corporate bonds. So we like mortgage-backed securities a lot. And broadly speaking, we like credit that is reasonably middle of the capital structure or higher, and its maturity is between 2 years and 7 years. We're not really interested in long-term bonds. We don't like the base rate being Treasury bonds, which one of the reasons I think that spreads are tight is there's growing awareness that Treasuries might not be as independent and risk-free as we thought of them, say, 10, 20 years ago.
And Jeffrey, before we close out, I know we're coming up to time, but thematically speaking, artificial intelligence, AI, continues to be top of mind for us here at the UBS Chief Investment Office. Generally speaking, what are your thoughts on AI in terms of its overall impact to current economic activity and the potential it has for future impact on the economy?
Well, I think I'm not alone in believing that it's obviously going to eliminate some drudgery types of jobs, and it could have an impact that would be higher unemployment while that's occurring. I also think that AI, it's a tool. I don't have this doom and gloom view that people have. It's the end of human civilization. It's just another tool. It's just mega, mega, mega computing power, which takes massive amounts of electricity. So I think, kind of like in the gold rush in 1949, the people that made the money were the people that sold picks, shovels, and jeans. Not the people that were trying to strike it rich generally didn't make it, but the people that supplied them made it. So I think that things that are energy-related, electricity-related, are one way to play AI. I also think that When new technologies come in, people get tremendously excited about the possibilities, and they tend to overstate the possibilities, at least prematurely. Maybe they come to pass ultimately, but the excitement gets way out of hand prematurely. And I saw that Ken Griffin was in the news today saying he sees the AI thing having echoes of the .com, and I've been saying that now for a couple of months. So I agree with Ken Griffin. And I think back, one of the most amazing things, an anecdote I like to tell, is in 1900, everybody saw the future of electricity. The electricity in homes and the streetlights and everything else was going to change the world. And they were absolutely right. I mean, the world obviously was changed in a really unprecedented way almost with electricity. But the interesting thing is that by 1911, when almost nobody had electrification, it was just getting started, only rich people, the very rich, had electricity in their home. at that time. But electricity stocks stopped their outperformance versus non-electricity market in 1911. So since 1911 until today, the stock market ex electricity stocks has outperformed electricity stocks. It was all priced in within a decade. And the world moves quicker today. So it's all momentum. And I just say, Dan, as growing up a bond guy, bond people have to overanalyze risk, because in bonds, you make money slowly and you lose money quickly, because they get downgraded or default very quickly, and you have a much bigger loss than you get a gain if something goes right. So we tend to be trained as bond people to be non-momentum investors. I think I'm that way to a fault even, but that's just the way I sleep at night. So I don't like momentum investing unless it's in the early stages, and I don't think the AI momentum investing can be classified as the early stages. In fact, it looks to me, as Ken Griffin saying, a little bit of an echo, and we have very, very high valuations. And so I favor non-U.S. stocks for the dollar reason and for the valuation reason. I think investors should have something in real assets, like 20%, maybe even 25% of their portfolio. Commodities are not working except for silver and gold, which have worked so well that it seems like a poor entry point. But I still own gold, and I still own gold miners in my personal portfolio. And I think that real assets, land, not housing, which looks like it's going to be under pressure, at least in the near term, with affordability being a problem. But the things like land, the biggest purchase that I made in the past 4 years was large acreage land, a farm, if you will. So that's where I am. And again, thanks for having me, Dan. I enjoy talking to you and your team every fall.
Well, Jeffrey, as always, very generous with your time, your guidance, and for sharing with us your insights. Always a pleasure having you with us here on UBS On Air. Thank you for spending some time today with our listeners, clients, and of course, look forward to our next conversation. Thank you again, Jeffrey.
All right. Thanks again, and good luck, everybody, with the rest of 2025. Won't be long now, so we're talking the outlook for 2026.
Definitely.
Bye for now.
Look forward to having you back. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.